Hello and welcome to the Arms Control Poser Podcast. My name is William Albrecht, Director of Strategy, Technology, and Arms Control at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Berlin. I will be your host as we explore the world of arms control. On each podcast, I will interview the great and the good of the arms control community about a current event related to a treaty or agreement, past, present, or only proposed. Then together, we will go, hopefully, deep enough on the history and functioning of the agreement to help you make sense of it all. And, well, that's the idea anyway. This podcast is funded by the European Union Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Consortium. Now let's get underway. All right, and welcome to today's podcast. I am very grateful to have, as our special guest today, Simon Clibbery. He is the head of Arms Control and Disarmament at the Geneva Center for Security Policy and is in Geneva right now to talk to us about artificial intelligence and some threats here. Simon, first of all, thank you for being here. Very grateful to have you here.
Thank you very much, William. It's great to be here.
We've chosen this topic together. So why don't you tell me, what is the threat that we're talking about here? What kind of threats do artificial intelligence pose? And we'll start there.
So the number one concern in the disarmament and arms control community about AI is around a weapon system that uses AI to operate, but that might not have sufficient human control built in over its decision-making processes, so that the decisions to select and attack a target could be made without any human involvement or without sufficient human involvement. And of course, if that were to happen, the big risk is that the AI could decide to attack someone or something that it shouldn't be, and that a human wouldn't choose to attack. And this might be because of some bias built into the data that it uses to operate, or quite frankly, that it does something that us humans would never have thought of and would never have suspected that the AI would do. So I think the real threat in such a situation is that of serious humanitarian and security consequences. On the humanitarian side, breaches of international humanitarian law, attacking civilians, for example. And then on the security side, if the weapon system does something that sparks a conflict or exacerbates an existing conflict.
So this is all really interesting as a concept. And the way you approached it is, you know, one of the things that I always think about, as you said, this is a concern in the arms control community that there's going to be decision making by weapons enabled with AI that will leave a human out of the loop or will modify or distort how humans see something to make it more likely to have conflict. How realistic is this threat? Are there countries that are incorporating AI that are taking humans out of the loop, which is a common understanding for international humanitarian law? Is this a threat that we see today, or is this a threat that we're worried about in the future? Is this a threat that we're on the cusp, where you see things that are happening where this is actually likely or emerging and happening right now?
So I'm reassured from the conversations I've had with military colleagues that actually, from a military perspective, they would never develop a system that had no human control over it. There would always be a human making decisions around selection and targeting and when to attack. So I'm reassured from that perspective. But of course, we're talking about state militaries, and I guess there's a risk of what non-state actors might do. And I would say I'm also reassured, certainly in terms of the intergovernmental discussions, that there is everyone agrees that international humanitarian law applies, and that there always should be a human in the decision making process. So I'm reassured by that. But I think what I think is on people's minds and what's worrying people is that the technology is moving so fast that we might come up against a situation whereby those kind of reassurances that countries have given kind of orally in meetings and within their militaries is not sufficient to be able to regulate it. And I hope that doesn't happen. And as I say, I'm reassured by the conversations I've had on the military side. But I think in the absence, and many people would argue that in the absence of fixed agreements and regulation on this, that actually militaries could do this in the future, and it's that kind of, I don't know, almost kind of Wild West field that if it's not regulated, then someone might go too far.
You know, I don't want to argue against this, because certainly, you know, one of the things that you learn about when you study the history of arms control is that often the places where you get the best agreements, the most lasting agreements, are the ones where the primary countries that could do this decide they don't really want to, and therefore ban it. You know what I mean? It's much harder to ban something that everyone or at least one party thinks is incredibly useful. It's much easier to get rid of things like whether it's chemical weapons or biological weapons when the US and the Soviets decided, no, we don't really need this. Then it was much easier to enter into an agreement. So, you know, I do think there is utility in having such an agreement. But it also strikes me, this is really interesting. This is one of those problems that people have been wrestling with for as long as people have been aware of computers. One thing that's interesting to go back, if you read Herman Kahn's On Thermonuclear War, actually the movie Dr. Strangelove based the idea of the doomsday computer that would read the conditions and launch nuclear war on something that Herman Kahn described in that book. There's another great Cold War movie called War Games, where, you know, an artificial intelligence decides it's going to start World War III because it gets confused. There's other science fiction where AI decides to get rid of humans, Terminator. So this is a problem that we've been wrestling with, at least in fiction, for decades and decades. But you're saying that we're now reaching a point where it may be more of a threat in the future. And so there is a possibility to have a conversation about limiting these types of technologies. Have there been successful efforts in the past? And are there efforts underway now? In what fora are these conversations happening? And, you know, what are the prospects for the future?
So, yes, I think, just to go back to what you said, I think disarmament diplomats have been talking for a while now about the potential impact of emerging technologies on arms control. But they have been doing it in different places. It's been rather fragmented. And no one quite knows how and where to have the conversation. So that's why I've become interested in this. On the point about what agreements we have at the moment, there's and what processes at the moment, there isn't really very much at the moment. In terms of the law, your starting place is, as I mentioned, international humanitarian law. But that, I think most people would argue that that's not sufficient because it wouldn't cover all scenarios. And the one process with a specific mandate to look at autonomy in weapon systems is the one on lethal autonomous weapon systems, which has been happening actually now for a good 10 years under the Convention on Certain Conventional Weapons, I think it would be fair to say has made some progress, but the progress is quite slow. I think there have been very good discussions around human in the loop, human involvement in decision making, but it hasn't got anywhere near to coming to an agreement or any new regulation on the issue. It has agreed 11 guiding principles on the use of lethal autonomous weapon systems, where everyone has agreed that IHL applies to all weapon systems, and including the potential development of laws, and that human responsibility for decision making must be retained. But they're just principles. They're not. I don't think I would describe them as regulation, because they're not legally binding. So there's quite a scope for new discussions in this area. But I think the problem is that the disarmament community, and something that I'm trying to help with, is the disarmament community doesn't know quite where and how, what format, what body to have these discussions in, and how that new regulation would be generated.
Can you back up then and tell me a little bit about the Convention on Certain Weapon Systems, CCW, talks? Where does that happen? Who's in the room? And specifically, who has agreed to these 11 guiding principles? I mean, I'm sure it's easy enough to get Western countries to sign up, but does that include China? Does that include India, Pakistan, North Korea, Iran? Tell me a little bit more about the CCW.
So the CCW is a convention. It's a bit like an umbrella convention. You have the convention itself, and then you have protocols that sit underneath it. But actually, the what has been established on lethal autonomous weapon system is what's called a group of governmental experts, and so it's the people in the room for that are all the they're called high contracting parties for this convention. So it's all the states that have signed up to the CCW. So that's not everyone, but it does include all the P5 countries, for example. So it's quite a major representation of the states of the UN member states, but it doesn't have everyone in the room, so it's not fully inclusive, and that's something that needs to be borne in mind when we think about what a future process might look like. Should it be in the General Assembly, for example, where you get every country?
And you said so. Part of what you're doing is you're trying to advise states on okay. Great, a GGE, so a governmental group of experts, has agreed to these 11 guiding principles. But how exactly do you give that teeth? I mean, does that go to the CD? Does that go to the General Assembly? Is it a standalone treaty or agreement? Is it like missile technology control regime? Will certain countries sign up to it and other countries not? What's your vision for how this gets turned into something real?
So,
I mean, not real. How do you turn this into something that has a little bit more bite, a little bit more binding nature in the international system?
Yeah, I mean, there are several options. If you wanted to stay within the CCW, which is what a lot of the major militaries want to do, you could continue with the GGE and continue discussions. Many people want those discussions to lead to a new legally binding agreement, which would probably take the form of a new protocol to the CCW. So that's what they would be looking for there. Mm. Now, you could take it out of that convention and have a fully standalone process, probably started off in the General Assembly. Create a new process through the General Assembly, which, as I said, would have everyone involved. But you could have the negotiations through the UN, and then if you came up with an agreement, then everyone would join it or not in the usual way. The other options would be you can have discussions in the CD. Of course, the CD has a negotiating mandate. The problem with, and that's the Conference on Disarmament. The problem with the Conference on Disarmament is that it only has 65 members. Although the advantage to the CD is that it does have all the major military powers in the room. It could negotiate a treaty, and then once that was adopted, then others could join it in the usual way as well. But I think the problem with the CD is that it is very deadlocked at the moment. There is an initiative from Pakistan, actually, to try and get discussions going in the CD on the military use of AI, they've suggested a new agenda item. They've suggested having a working group on the subject. Those are not impossible, but the problem is with the CD at the moment that it's very deadlocked, and I don't think... And you need consensus to agree on anything there. So the prospects of going down the CD route, I think, are pretty unlikely. I think either the CCW route or the UN General Assembly route would be more likely. A final option would be to create a new body to address AI and arms control, perhaps across the board. But I think there would be a number of challenges to even setting that up, and then even once you had it, I think there would be a lot of issues that you'd need to think through.
Certainly, when I'm sure you have the same experience, you know, when we talk to folks in governments, especially in ministries of foreign affairs or the ministries of defense who work on these kinds of things, the things that they say are, you know what, we need more of more formats. We need more formats that I have to cover. More things, you know. It becomes a problem. It's one of the things, certainly like looking at outer space, countries trying to cover Vienna and Geneva and New York on these topics can be a real challenge. So you can see just from an inertial point of view or from a bureaucratic and function point of view that you'd want to keep it in an existing format. like CCW rather than create something new. But I wanted to ask about the CD for just a second. Part of the reason, my understanding of part of the reason why the CD is deadlocked is because of the blockage, the lack of agreement on moving forward on a fissile material cutoff treaty, one of whose principal offenders here would be Pakistan. So I'm really curious, is that the blockage in the CD? What's the division in the CD that would prevent something like this to coming to the table if a country like Pakistan's the one that's actually pushing for agreement?
Well, traditionally, the blockage on the CD, you mentioned the Fissile Material Cutoff Treaty, was over making progress on that and then making progress on space security, particularly on the Paros agenda item. And the two tended to be played off against each other, saying, well, if we're going to do that, then we have to do that one as well. The situation in the CD has deteriorated over the last few years in such a way that I really don't think that anyone, whichever country it was, bringing an initiative right now would succeed. I mean, I think unlikely that they would succeed in starting up a new negotiation. But even getting a new agenda item, I think would be very tricky, just because unfortunately the atmosphere is so bad at the moment. Right. I mean, I think that, you know, politics is everywhere in the CD, and you know, if Pakistan bring an initiative on AI, there would be some who would say, well, why are you doing that? Are you trying to divert attention away from the FMCT? Or, you know, that's the way people's mindset in the CD works at the moment. So I think the prospects of that are slim, actually.
And so you think CCW is the most optimal way, or would you say the UN General Assembly would be the right way? Which, if you had to advise your government, you know, which path would you choose?
So I think the CCW route is your best chance of binding in all the countries that you need to sign up to this, because the militarily the countries that are have most capabilities in this area are obviously the ones that you want to be bound into any kind of regulation. Otherwise it wouldn't be very effective. Now, the downside of that is that the CCW is a consensus body, and so any one country could ensure that there's no progress made. If you go down the General Assembly route, it may be much easier to come up with an agreement, but then it would be much harder to get everyone signed up to that you needed to. So one thing that I think will be quite important to think about is what else you can do around that. And I think bilateral discussions will be very important. And I think the two key players here are the US and China, trying to get them to have arms control discussions is very tricky at the moment, but perhaps talking about AI is a way into it, because they're the two most advanced in this area. If not bilateral, then perhaps in a minilateral format. In better times, I would have suggested that perhaps it could have been done through the P5 process. But of course, that's deadlocked at the moment because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So you then perhaps need to think beyond those the bilateral and the minilateral, and think whether states can do things unilaterally declarations of policy on AI and military use of AI can help build confidence and help build a common understanding about how it's used. And then I think you might see states coming together for joint statements of the kind of political declaration variety. And in fact, I think you should look out for what the US are doing on this. I think they're looking to do a political declaration on the military use of AI. So it'd be interesting to see how many people they get signed up. But ultimately, each one of these options I've gone through doesn't have the guarantee of getting everyone to sign up. So that's the real challenge. But of course, that's been a challenge in arms control for as long as anyone can remember. Yeah. So that aspect is not new.
Yeah, and the more countries you can get to sign up to a clearly articulated set of rules or norms, the more you're able to point at that and say, you know, to countries that violate that your behavior is beyond the pale, the more you're able to identify bad behavior and to call it out. Otherwise, anything's permitted, so no one can complain about anything. You have to get something down on paper somewhere in order to really be able to start holding people to account.
Yes, I agree with that. And I'm doing some thinking at the moment about what might be done. I mean, the problem is that traditionally arms control has taken a long time. And you have to, in fact, you kind of deliberately build in very long consultative processes, and then negotiations can take years. And in this area, perhaps we don't actually have all that time, but maybe that could be a blessing. Maybe actually, if you can agree something, maybe that would be quite high level. Maybe even just a political declaration not to use technology in a way that breaches international law, and you can build in some way of giving it some teeth and get all the major players to sign up to it. Then at least that gives you something in an area where we don't have anything at the moment, and that can give people reassurance.
Yeah, I think this is a good idea. I don't want to push back on something like this, but there is that thing that tells me that okay, we can get all the good people to agree not to do bad things, but the bad people are still going to do bad things. I think this is worth doing. But the other thing that sits sort of in the back of my head as I think about this is, the worst atrocities that we've seen, you know, you think of Ukraine and Russia, are decisions by humans to try to kill as many civilians as humanly possible, unleashing anti-ship cruise missiles on shopping malls and things like that. So I do think it's worth doing, because I think there's a lot more risk of even more dangerous types of decisions being made. But people make horrible enough decisions that
it's another element to why this is so challenging, is that the existing arms control architecture is under real pressure at the moment, and you know you talk there about breaches of international law, international humanitarian law, but also the disarmament arms control architecture itself is under a lot of pressure at the moment, and you see people, countries breaching agreements, you see countries leaving agreements. And so I think that it means that the environment now for entering into new agreements, where you need a certain amount of trust and goodwill, and the political geopolitical environment needs to be ripe for those negotiations to be successful. We just don't have that at the moment, so it is very challenging. But I agree with you that humans are quite capable of making terrible decisions themselves. they don't need the AI to do it for them.
That's a good place to take a quick pause. When we come back with Simon Clayberry, we're going to continue our discussion on artificial intelligence. You're listening to William Alberg on the Arms Control Poser podcast. And it is one thing. I mean, when you think about AI as well, it's another thing that that Russia's war in Ukraine has reminded me, and I'm trying to think about this in an arms control point of view. In the West, we have a very different valuation. You know, you think about the US or the UK's complete aversion to casualties, that first of all, you know, the loss of any of their own soldiers is a huge issue, and loss of civilian life. The West has deliberately spent the past 30 years trying to improve its ability not to target, or you know, not to indiscriminately kill people in warfare. And of course, sometimes we've fallen short of that, but we're trying. But then you look at Russia in Chechnya, or you look at Russia in Syria, or you look at Russia in Ukraine, and they see killing civilians as a benefit, not as a fault to be ironed out of the system. They still appear to think the Italian air power theorist Duet, the idea that destroying cities is a way to win wars, you know, something very different than how we conceive of warfare. And so then when you think about a country might, like Russia, might agree, oh yeah, yeah, you know, we have to make sure that AI doesn't support terrible decisions, but they think good decisions includes flattening cities and killing civilians or hitting, you know what I mean? It becomes a little bit more complicated. Again, that's not an argument against this. Just because there are lots of people who speed doesn't mean you shouldn't have speeding limits. You know what I mean? You still need some kind of rule that you can point to so that you can develop norms that then change behavior. But it is something that I keep in the back of my mind as I watch all the casualties mount up in the war in Ukraine, that we just think very differently about human life and warfare than Russia does when it executes a war.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm no technical expert, but the AI uses the data that it's fed. You know, if the AI develops in such a way that it's kind of, it acts like its human operator would, then yeah, those situations could well, again, you hope they wouldn't, but you could foresee situations where the AI is thinking very differently according to who is sitting behind it. And I think that's made me think of another major challenge here, which is definitions and verification, which of course is always an issue with arms control. But but how on earth do we verify how AI is within a weapon system is operating and would operate in a certain situation? How do we verify that, and how do we draft a treaty that captures that?
Can't even very verify challenging. Whether our kids are using AI to write papers. How are we, you know? And I mean, I know that sounds glib, but you know, okay, so what if a leader promises you that his decision-making promise on going to war is, you know, not being controlled by artificial intelligence, but then he's trying to sort some decision out and he, you know, goes to an AI generator and asks for advice, you know, is that, even if we get agreement that it shouldn't be done, there still may be people who in that loop are so overwhelmed in that decision loop on war or killing may seek solace in using AI to sort of ameliorate their own guilt about decision making and hand that over. So verification becomes kind of a nightmare then.
There. Exactly, and then the issue of responsibility, if something terrible happens, you know, whose fault was it, and then you have access to justice issues, perhaps. So it opens up a lot of you know, legal and ethical humanitarian issues.
Here's where I think the phrase arms control. I recall Heather Williams, who's at CSIS and Pony in the United States, said, you know, arms control needs a rebranding because we use the word arms control, the phrase arms control. We think automatically, okay, it has to be a written treaty. It has to be legally binding. There has to be verification. There has to be consequences for violating it. And then you think, well, okay, but the way we govern the sea, the way that we govern aircraft, the way that we are now talking about governance in outer space, you don't necessarily need that. First, it would be nice if we had some sort of set of rules and norms and principles that we can agree upon. And if in the future we can get to a legally binding treaty, sure, okay. But at this stage, it would be nice if we could walk before we ran. It's like somebody saying right now we need a legally binding treaty to outlaw any kind of AI in decision-making on force. It's just such a huge ask, whereas saying, okay, we have these 11 guiding principles. How can we get this into a wider agreement? And then, you know, in the future, sure, towards a path that could be legally binding, but having just agreed upon rules and norms would be a nice first step. Or am I being not ambitious enough? Should we be thinking automatically about jumping into arms control with verification and inspectors and all that kind of stuff?
I think there is an opportunity here to look at how we do arms control. And as I was saying, I think the kind of traditional way of doing it is going to be very challenging here. So I think we should look for opportunities to do things differently. I think the processes that we've had, particularly the process on outer space and responsible space behaviors, is one that could be looked at here, because actually it's coming to a common understanding about how to use this technology, and be aware of what each other is up to, so that there are no that reduces the risk of miscalculation and misunderstanding, I think is quite a good model to borrow from. That still requires a lot of dialogue, a lot of consultation, and it requires states to genuinely commit to that process and be sufficiently open and transparent to share policies and doctrines in that area. But that, I think, is definitely got to be part of the picture. I think I don't know. It's a very difficult one, this. And one thing that might happen is that if we take a step away from just talking about AI in the arms control context, and we talk about AI writ large in terms of AI safety and all that's going on there, the Secretary General's call for a body based in Geneva to do AI governance modeled on the IAEA in Vienna, if we had a body like that, could that actually play, I'm assuming that would be agreed by members of the UN, I don't know whether it will be, but if you had a body that was looking at the AI safety, could that then feed in to what happens in the arms control sector in terms of kind of setting codes of conduct and setting guidelines for how to use AI that would then inform what we do in the arms control world and actually perhaps even do some of the job for us, if you know what I mean, so that you're not completely starting from scratch? Because if arms control diplomats did that, I think you're in for long processes that may never reach agreement.
That sounds like it makes more sense to me. Something where you would create almost a global advisory board, best standards and practices, a place where countries could positively go and evaluate, and countries that were worried about what other countries are doing, to create a forum where they could have dialogue about stated policies and to try to address any discrepancies in implementation, but not in a harshly legalistic, everything written down to the letter, but more in an advisory way in order to set policies on the right course and to provide opportunities for dialogue where we think countries are going off course.
Yeah. And another thing that we haven't talked about yet is the role of industry here, or the role of the technical people who are sitting in these AI labs and coming up with this technology. Right. How do we get them involved? How do we make sure that they're involved with these processes? Now, I might be wrong about this, but the people that are working in the AI labs probably don't know so much about UN multilateral disarmament processes. And so trying to get the two to speak to each other is quite a challenge. And if you try to bring them straight into arms control talks, that might not be so successful. But if you brought them into a broader UN effort on AI safety more generally, and of course I think some of the big tech companies are very much engaging with this and calling for it, then that's a good way of getting them in. I think something I've quite a campaigner for is getting industry more involved with arms control work. But you have to do it. You have to do it carefully, because you can't. It's no good just saying, "Oh, come to a meeting of the CD or come to a meeting of the first committee." You need to involve them in a way that they understand why they're being involved, and they're not just sitting there listening to diplomats reeling off statement after statement.
Yeah, no, this is something I've been thinking about as well, especially on outer space. I've spoken with some government folks who said, "Oh no, you know, we had a meeting and we briefed industry and we're good." And it's like, no. Industry is going to be changing and evolving, and especially on AI. Industry is going to be changing and evolving at a rate that we can't even imagine. And so how do you create then a regular forum where you bring industry together, where it's in their interest, even though they're competing, to have this kind of conversation, and then have governments able to access that and exchange information with industry? Because sometimes industry may come up with governance ideas or concepts amongst themselves that is very useful. So we want to take advantage of that. But at the same time, we need to keep abreast of developments in industry that could ultimately, because of perfectly normal logic and commercial logic, could end up creating a destabilizing technology or a destabilizing system. So you need something that has both angles to it, where industry is incentivized to come together and talk, the conversation with government as well, but then also government can send messages and communicate with and keep industry engaged. Are there any examples that you can think of where that exists and that works?
Oh, that's a good question. I very much agree with you. And I wondered whether actually, if you did have such a body, and you had genuine engagement from the industry, that would actually be an incentive for all the governments that you need to be in the room and involved with the process, the ones that you're particularly concerned about, because they would want to know what industry is up to as well. So I think that's quite a good model. Now, your question about whether there's such a body, I can't immediately think of one, William. Actually, I mean, I know this, the SG has suggested modeling on the IAEA. I think that that's not. That doesn't quite address the point on industry that you're making. I think I would like to reflect on that one, but I think it's. I think something like that. That genuinely brings the two together, and is not just industry coming to a UN multilateral meeting and listening to statement after statement. That won't work. But a genuine dialogue, and making industry understand that they very much need to be part of creating the regulation here.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It should be possible to convince industry that they need to know what's going on simply in order to be able to function in this field, because governments may come up with some ideas that are untenable or unviable, or simply just limit what industry wants to do. So they need to know about that. They need to have some input. And at the same time, governments need to be able to inform and engage with industry as well, and let them know what's happening and solicit input. Industries, if you could actually get it off the ground, if you could demonstrate to industry that there is value in this and that they have a certain positive position in terms of informing governments and having some influence, then it becomes a network good. Then everyone's going to want to be in that room. And you know what I mean? It becomes something where all of industry would then want to be there, because if they saw that some industry was having a voice, you wouldn't want to be left out of that. And the same thing with governments, if they think, well, this is actually effective in talking to the people who are making these changes at the bleeding edge, then governments would want to be in that room as well. But structuring that, I can't think of examples.
What I would do to start with, what I would do to start with was try and build it up at the national level first. So you get governments talking to their industry at their domestic level, and then perhaps you then build it up regionally or within small groupings, and you kind of build it up like that. As to whether you could ever agree on such an AI governance body, I don't know. It depends how you wanted to create it. I mean, if you created it through the General Assembly, then you could do it without having everyone's buy-in. But if you wanted everyone's buy-in to establish it, that might be more challenging.
I think these are good ideas, though, and it's something that has to be explored. And again, maybe one of our listeners is going to come up with an example that I just haven't thought of, but I do think this is something where there's some new thinking that needs to happen, and it can have benefits and it can really help moving forward.
So the hook for all these discussions, and something that listeners should follow is the work that's going into the Summit of the Future next year, and in particular the new agenda for peace, which has a significant arms control element, and a significant part of that is on AI and new technology. So I think that people like myself and you, William, should be thinking about how we might do this and feed ideas into that process, because it's a useful hook, I think, for if we want something on AI to come out of that, then it's a good moment. You know, diplomats always look for good moments to agree things and announce things. So that would be a good moment, I think, to announce it at the Summit of the Future next year.
Well, so is there anything else that we need to think about in terms of barriers or in terms of what's next? What are you thinking as you look at this problem set? I think we've come up with some good ideas and a real hook to move this into the future. But you know, what else am I missing here?
I think we've covered quite a lot on the barriers. One thing that I haven't mentioned yet is, I mentioned time that it takes to negotiate these things, but I also wanted to mention timing, because you talk to people about this issue and you get very different answers. And some people say that, it's too soon to regulate AI and arms control because we don't know where it's going. But then paradoxically, you get other people saying, it's too late. you know, the genie is out of the bottle now. This is a thing. It's too late to regulate. So one thing I think to watch out for is that I think that there may not, or there isn't agreement at the moment on timing and of when to have these discussions. So that's something that's certainly another potential barrier I see. In terms of what to look out for and what's coming up, we're in the middle of the UN General Assembly's first committee, the Disarmament and International Security First Committee. I think we'll see for the first time a new resolution on autonomous weapon systems, which will create a new agenda item and will start a consultative process on this, asking states the very question that you asked me earlier about where they see the discussions on autonomous weapon systems going. And that, I think, you know, that could lead to a new process through the GA. So we should, you know, for example, the creation of a working group. The next meeting of the CCW is next month in November. There'll be a decision there on what next on the group of governmental experts. So we need to look out for that as well. Then also away from the conference rooms or away from the UN conference rooms, we should look at, I think there are going to be more and more summits and conferences on this issue. One to watch is the one that started this year by the Dutch government, the REAIM summit. It's the Responsible Artificial Intelligence in the Military Domain summit, which met for the first time this year and will meet again next year, hosted by the Republic of Korea. That's an example of, I mean, it didn't have everyone attending, but it's an example of a group of countries coming together they made a call for action on this issue, and they could come together on common understandings in this issue. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I think look out for political declarations, and particularly the one that the US is looking to do. And we just talked about the new agenda for peace and the summit for the future. I think that that is a process that is... it's got a huge agenda, but I tend to think that AI is such a big issue now across the board for everyone that we should be looking for something on AI coming out of that.
Well, so yeah, it sounds like there are at the UN level, at the CCW level, at the minilateral level, track 1.5, track 1, and track 2 discussions. But what really needs to happen, as you point out, this stuff takes time. But putting this all into a framework and taking the guidelines, the unilateral declarations, and trying to put that in a system, I think that's to try to organize all this and try to think about what a good end state would be, would then help to clarify all these processes, because there's always the danger that you're going to have all these processes spinning in different directions, coming up with their own products, but there's no real unifying theory underneath it. Here, I think about, you know, in the NPT, you have NPDI, you have IPNDV, you have SEND, you have this Stockholm Initiative. You've got all these different things, but no one's saying, okay, how does this all fit together and actually make change? What's the end state we're aiming for here? So it strikes me that there's a lot of good work that could still happen in terms of, let's go ahead and articulate what some of these norms should be. Let's look at how all of this could fit together. And then you could use all of these existing formats to make advances until it can rationalize itself and coalesce and become more of a cogent, coherent way forward.
Yes, and so that would be the advantage of having a body that could bring everyone together to have these discussions in one place, would be that you would reduce the risk of fragmented and piecemeal regulation on this. And you would hope that that body could bring some level of uniformity to what states are agreeing on this. Now, presumably that body then wouldn't have the mandate to be able to amend existing treaties. It would then have to be sent down to the level of the treaty or the body that you're talking about. But if it had been agreed at the kind of the higher body level, then you increase the chances of getting good regulation that is then consistent across the piece, and it avoids that the fragmentation that you talked about.
I think that's it exactly. Well, what do you think? I think we've just about covered it. I think we've got a good idea of what's going on, what to look out for, what kinds of things that need to happen next. Any final thoughts?
Just to thank you very much, William. I through the course of talking to you, have already got two or three things to go away and research and hopefully come up with some ideas to feed back into the arms control community. So thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, that's great. Thank you. I've learned a lot as well. And hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast relatively soon when you've thought of some of these ideas even more and you've got some proposals.
Cool.
Pick it up and push it forward.
Pressure on.
Thank you very much, Simon. Simon Cleberry, Head of Arms Control and Disarmament at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. Thank you for this conversation. That about does it for part one. When we come back in part two, we'll talk about Simon Cleberry's life and times. Thank you very much. And we're back with part two. And part two here, I'm going to talk to Simon about his life and his career. So let's start with how you got to where you are right now, and then we'll go back in time a little bit further. So how did you get your current job? What were you doing before? You were in the UK government, is that right?
Yes. So before the role at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, which I started just a few months ago in July, I spent just under 11 years with the UK Foreign Office, first in New York, at the UK mission to the UN in New York, working in the Security Council team, and more recently at the UK mission to the UN in Geneva as the Deputy Disarmament Ambassador. So I did over 10 years of work on international security, first in the Security Council and then here in Geneva on disarmament and arms control.
How did you get the New York job? Was that just a job that was listed in the paper one day and you said, throw in a resume? How did that happen?
Well, I blame my wife. So my wife got a great job with the Office of the Legal Counsel in the UN Secretariat in New York. And so we decided to move to New York. And well, the job at the UK mission was advertised, actually.
Wow.
It was a local role. The UK Foreign Office has a number of local contracts across the network, and it was quite innovative at the time. It was the first time they'd localized a frontline foreign policy role in the Security Council team, and I moved to New York at the right time, and I applied for it and got it, and it really changed my life, because representing your country at the UN Security Council on some of the most pressing security issues of the day was just absolutely fantastic. It was the most wonderful experience.
Yeah. Absolutely amazing. And so then how and why the switch to the UK and Geneva?
Again, my wife's fault. She transferred with the UN to Geneva to take a role at UNHCR. We had two children by then. And so we moved the family to Geneva. And again, I was very fortunate that a role came up at the UK mission. And again, unusually for a deputy ambassador role, it was a local contract. So again, someone was smiling on me from above, and the stars aligned, and I got this great role in the UK disarmament team.
Why did you leave, and why the Geneva Center for Security Policy? I mean, aside from it actually being in Geneva, so it has that virtue. How did that job come up, and how and why did you transfer from the UK government to this NGO?
So I had been in the role as UK Deputy Disarmament Ambassador for 6 years. And in fact, that's probably as long as any diplomat posted out from London would do. So I felt that there was a kind of natural life span to the role, and so I felt that I wanted to move on and develop my career by challenging myself to do something else, but I very much wanted to stay in the realm of international relations, and when the role at the GCSP came up, it made a lot of sense for me to move across. I will be very honest with you, William. I got quite frustrated with the disarmament processes that we were working on. Okay. And I enjoyed working on the issues, but actually I really fancied a change from sitting in some of those meetings, which, to put it politely, were not the most dynamic. So I wanted to come across to a non-governmental organization. And I wanted to give something back, actually. My role here at GCSP is quite multifaceted. There's a teaching element to it, but there's a facilitation element to it. There's a researching and writing element. There's a putting on events element. And I very much, my top priority in the role is to help the disarmament community, particularly here in Geneva, but of course globally as well, to try and address some of these really difficult challenges that we're working on, and use the experience of having been in the conference room, but then use the freedom that comes with not representing a country anymore to perhaps be a bit more creative to try and come up with some solutions to these problems. So that was my motivation, and I'm loving it so far.
Wow, well, that sounds wonderful. But let me throw back a little bit further. So how did you get into arms control in the first place? I mean, just as an intellectual concept, as a part of your career, is this something you thought about when you were younger? Is this something you studied at university? When did you first become aware of the arms control, you know, career field and topics, and start looking into it? Or is this something that just because of the job you ended up having the opportunity and, you know, got the bug?
I would say it's linked to the role I did at the UK mission in Geneva. I didn't have any pre-existing expertise or knowledge in the area, although I had done 5 years in the Security Council. So
arms control was not a pre-existing condition. That's good to know. Okay.
I'd always been interested in international relations and diplomacy. And in fact, looking back to when I was at school, that's what I wanted to do, is to be a diplomat. But I would say what I love about the work I do is coming at it from the politics and the diplomatic angle. I'm not coming at it particularly being an expert on military matters. It's more the politics of it. But of course, I've learned that through the role.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in London. And lived there till I was six, and then we moved to the beautiful city of Canterbury in the southeast of England, where I went to school until the age of 18. I then went back to London for university. I studied modern history at University College London, and I enjoyed my history so much that I then went off to Oxford University to do a master's in historical research, which was a very pleasant year. But I didn't take the research any further, and at that point I went to law school back in London. So my first career was as a corporate lawyer. I worked for global law firm Baker McKenzie. So I had quite a significant career change when I got the role at the UK mission in New York. And then of course I've recently changed careers again. So I would say, don't be afraid if you're starting out, don't be afraid to, you know, do one thing and then know that you can pivot and do something else, because that's worked very well for me.
That's kind of the question that I like to close with, but just to ask it a little bit more pointedly and see if we can get something from you here. If you could go back to yourself at any point during your education or career and give yourself advice that would benefit you either at that time or throughout your career all the way to now, is there anything you could jump in a time machine, you know something now that you didn't know then, that you'd tell a younger version of yourself? What is it, and when would that be?
Well, when I look back on my choices, I and my choice to become a lawyer, It's worked out very well for me, and I don't regret it at all, because I got fantastic training at a great firm, and it really set me up professionally. But I would, if I'm honest with you, I slightly jumped on a bandwagon, because a lot of my friends and peers were all going off to law school and becoming lawyers, and I don't think I gave it enough thought, actually, as to whether that was really what I wanted to do, and. In a sense, I think it's right that I don't see myself as wanting to be a lawyer for the whole of my career. But having said that, you know, the legal background has been really useful to my diplomatic career. Mm. And it's still really useful for me as a disarmament and arms control expert, because at the end of the day, what is arms control but legal agreements and negotiations? So so that's a roundabout way of saying I'm pretty happy with how it worked out, but also my younger self, I probably felt the pressure to, I must decide on a profession now, and I must go off from university and do that immediately. Whereas I could perhaps have thought, well, I'll do this for a while and know that I can then change careers at a later point, which I did do. So it's not a regret, but it's perhaps just, a reflection.
No, sure. I mean, things worked out, but just to be able to say to a younger version of yourself, you know, that a law degree may be a tool for your toolkit, but not a way of life, and to have courage to look beyond the framework of being a lawyer in terms of what you would do for your life. I mean, it's literally what you've ended up doing. So I think knowing that when you were younger might have maybe given yourself a little bit more comfort, a little bit more certainty about where you were going.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I would agree with that.
That's great. All right. I think that just about does it. Thank you very much once again, Simon, for being on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot, and I'm serious. I would like to have you back, because I think this is an area where things are moving really, really quickly. And there's also some really interesting other people out there. Maybe we can team up and bring another guest on and bounce some ideas off them as well, and hopefully advance our knowledge on the possibilities for arms control and AI in the future. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea. Yeah, I think we should take the opportunity here to bounce ideas off each other and try to be a bit creative. Fast moving, I think that that means that we can be right on the cutting edge of brainstorming some ideas about how to address these very serious challenges.
Simon, once again, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you so much, William. And hopefully I will see you on the next one.
And that's all we have time for today. My thanks once again to Simon Cleary for the great conversation. Thanks as always to the European Union Non-Proliferation and Disarmament Consortium for funding this podcast. Thanks to B. Aubrey Freeman for the excellent music. I've been William Alberg. See you next time on the Arms Control Poser podcast.
I repeat again. I repeat again. I repeat again. I repeat again. I repeat again.